Hello, it's Kamal Ahmed here, and I'm here to tell you about Energized, the brand new podcast Intelligence Squared is launching in partnership with Iberdrola. The climate crisis is the most pressing issue of our time. Temperatures are set to rise more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels in the next two decades, an increase that will cause irreversible damage to our planet. But is there still hope? If humans are to blame for climate change, then we must also provide the solutions. And that's where Energized comes in. Join me as I bring together experts and policymakers to delve deep into the key issues at the heart of the global drive towards net zero and the innovations that promise to accelerate the energy transition and transform the way we live. Just search Energized wherever you get your podcasts.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm Connor Boyle. Coming up on the show, with the world facing a climate crisis, how can travel and tourism be part of the solution? We'll be hearing how sustainability needs to be top of any traveller's itinerary. For this programme, Intelligence Squared partnered with the Singapore Tourism Board to bring together cross-industry experts to discuss how the travel and tourism industry can go beyond sustainable storytelling and help tackle some of the challenges facing the environment. Here's our host, Juliet Kinsman, sustainability editor at Condé Nast, with more.
I really, really am happy to welcome you to this very special event organised by the Singapore Tourist Board in partnership with Intelligence Squared and Singapore Imagined Global Conversations. So, sustainability. I'm just so happy we're finally all having this conversation. It's the word on everyone's lips. It's probably the word used too much, but you know how things have changed. And something I think a lot of us get bombarded with reports that tell us that today's consumer, 80% of them will choose the sustainable option or product or service. So we know it's important. But another report tells us that the big barrier or that challenges all of us is how can we tell something or anything is genuinely sustainable, and what does that even really mean? So thank you so much joining me this evening to discuss this topic. Well, I'm really thrilled to have three excellent speakers with me. I know we're going to have a really interesting conversation, so thank you so much. We have Kavita Prakash Mani. She is CEO of Mandai Nature. That's a Singapore-based conservation nonprofit. They aim to advance nature conservation with a focus on protecting threatened species from extinction, restoring ecosystems, driving nature-based solutions to mitigate climate change. This is what we all need. And creating benefits for local communities. We also have Jane Madden, Global Managing Partner of Sustainability and Social Impact at Finn Partners. She's an award-winning authority on ESG, environmental, social governance, policy, performance, and communications. Jane advises Fortune 500 companies across all different sectors, including CPG, manufacturing, and travel and tourism. Thank you. And we have Bjorn Lowe, Executive Director and co-founder of Edible Garden City, focusing on identifying the value that urban agriculture brings to communities that of high density and food import dependent cities such as Singapore. So thank you so, so much. So I'm going to start things off with a question I always love to ask because I always love to hear the answer. What does sustainable travel mean to you? So I'm going to start with you, Kavita.
Thanks, Juliet. And thank you all for this opportunity to be here. As you said, you know, from our perspective as Mandai Nature, we're really looking at protecting our wild places and our wild species. And for me, sustainable tourism stems from that. How do we use tourism for the good of nature, of people, to protect our climate? And that's where, you know, we also have in this current context, really, this rising sense of nationalism, like everyone's closing borders, looking inside, feeling threatened. COVID has made it worse. And I think the opportunity to learn, to experience, to be in different cultures, like we were hearing on the last panel, but really from a conservation perspective, to be grounded in nature is really something that tourism can do.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jane.
So I think both from a traveler's perspective, or if you're working in the travel industry, I talk about sustainable travel as being respectful not only for the environment, but also the culture, and that's the history, but also the social mores of a particular town or city or country that you're in, and also the people, whether those are the locals or the people that are serving you in restaurants, in hotels, housekeeping. We always tend to forget about all those people, and being a responsible traveler from an individual point of view, or from if you're running a business, I think encompasses all of that.
Absolutely, yes. And thank you. And Bjorn.
Yeah, but, what I feel is when sustainable tourism is about not being extractive when you go to a place and really regenerate the space that you visit so that you can improve yourself and also the people and the country that you visit.
I love that. Can you all actually just really just process that? That was a really, really great answers and really, you know, important. Kavita, you have spent decades working on many different sustainability challenges. Can you tell us a bit about your current work at Mandai Nature and how this fits in with our topic of this evening, which is walking the walk and why it is relevant to the conscious traveller?
Absolutely, very happy to. So from a Mandai Nature perspective, we are really looking at how do we protect wild species. To protect wild species, which could be anything from beautiful butterflies, turtles, songbirds, elephants, or even the Raffles banded langur, which is very unique to Singapore, we also need to protect the places and the habitats that they live in. And that is, again, tropical forests, mangroves, wetlands, grasslands, coral reefs. So all of these absolutely amazing places that we all love to visit. But intrinsic to that, I think Jane was saying, are the people. These are not always uninhabited people. They are indigenous peoples, local communities, local farmers that are all in those landscapes and have been for generations traditionally and culturally. And so working with them. So it all kind of ties together into this beautiful mosaic of life that we have. And in that context, we definitely do see the role of tourism. So what we call conservation tourism, which is taking a step forward from ecotourism. And conservation tourism is grounded in those concepts. I think with ecotourism, we come to it from the definition of, to put it simply, we want to go into a beautiful place and see a beautiful place. Whereas for conservation tourism, we start with saying we want to protect that beautiful place or those species, and we will design tourism to get to those basic tenets. And we've just put out a report this week, which we'll be happy to share details of, which kind of starts looking at those nuances.
I've read it. It's really good. So you do want to read it. I always call it nature positive tourism is one way of, it's really important. Thank you so much. Bjorn, one of your missions is to bring urban farming to cities to create social impact. Can you share a bit more with us about Edible Garden City and how it's created?
Yeah, so we started 10 years ago as a social enterprise in urban farming. Of course, the initial idea around it was to work on food security, because Singapore imports 90% of our food from 170 countries. We have 1% of our land dedicated to agriculture that produce 10% of our food. So we kind of looked in the urban spaces and activated rooftops, rooftop car parks, viaducts, into farms, into food production spaces. Of course, during that time, there was a big growth in hotels and sustainability efforts in hotels. So we have built about 270 of these edible gardens all around Singapore. So you can find them in hotels like Marina Bay Sands and, you know, Park Royal Bayfront. But what we really saw once we activated these spaces is that how the community has been impacted. You see the people and the children, the schools, and they come, they engage, and they learn about food sustainability and about growing. We also practice inclusive employment. So we provide jobs to the disadvantaged to participate in urban agriculture and farming. We have started to activate these spaces into care farms where we are providing therapeutic horticulture services to the community. So while it started from food sustainability, it became a lot more of a community social and environmental impact story that we are trying to
So I think the sustainability conversation, you know, even though it's advanced considerably recently, it's, you know, that usually people still associate it predominantly with the environment, and they just think, you know, they don't realize it's not just about place or nature. It's about people and it's about community. And I just think that's such an important conversation to be having, which of course then Jane will make me. Well, you know, I really would love to talk to you. You've worked across many different industries in terms of ESG. ESG is kind of endangered of becoming a buzzword in itself, but it's something that you understand better than anyone in terms of, well, performance, in terms of reporting. So in terms of walking the walk from a comms and brand point of view, what does that mean to you, and how do you work with clients to work more sustainably?
So one of our first rules when we're talking about sustainability communications is defining your terms. I define ESG, which, as Juliet said, just stands for environment, social, and governance. So it's a holistic look at sustainability. Those are the three pillars of sustainability. Second, I want to pick up on what Kavita said about protecting first. And it's something, and we're working with our clients, whether it's in the travel industry or energy industry or, you know, consumer products, it is to first protect them. Because 10 years ago, or even a few years ago, you could pat yourself on the back and say, we're a great company, we have purpose, we're wonderful, everybody should buy our products. You can't do that anymore. And not only can't you go out and just say you're great, you have to prove it. And you have to show how sustainability or ESG is integrated into your business. And if you don't have all of it at once, that's okay, but you can start talking about what you're doing now, as well as your commitments. Another rule we have is to be honest and modest. And it really doesn't help you or the audiences you're trying to reach if you're greenwashing or you're exaggerating what you're doing. And really, this is based on a foundation of transparency and data. So we always tell our clients, it is better to say that you're not there yet than to overpromise. And so we will help protect them and promote them. But ultimately, what we do, and I think we might be unique at Finn with how we work with our clients, we not only do communications. We help develop sustainability/ESG strategies. We do what's called a materiality assessment, which helps our clients prioritize this big world of ESG. It can be, it's everything that you do in the world. It can be encompassed in those three letters. So what are those main priorities? Is it the environment, social or governance, and those subcategories underneath that? We also help them develop these strategies, implement them, because at the end of the day, your communications mean nothing if you don't have action and data.
Thank you. It's so true. So yeah, so social, environmental, and we can also say economic. And that's what people sort of don't really realize. That's a big part of the sustainability conversation. I think, well, my own personal mantra always is, don't tell me you're sustainable, show me. Mm-hmm. And it's really qualifying that. And I think we need a lot less talk. We know that, and a lot more walk. Jane, I'm going to come back to you again. So, you know, I think this is the question I think is the most, one of the most interesting questions also to ask is, what do you think the greatest challenges are that are facing people and planet, right? We know it's the climate emergency, but what's the interplay of everything that's causing that? I'm going to ask you, I'm going to get Jane.
All right. Well, so of course there are many obstacles there, but for me, and one that I've been spending a lot of time on, particularly the past 2 years, is environmental justice. So looking at that intersection between the environment and social justice, what has now been called, and I'm going to read this quote so I make sure that I get it correct, we're talking about the intersectionality of the environment. And there is an environmental educator who coined this term, intersectional environmentalist, and she says, we need to acknowledge, and her name is Leah Thompson, We need to acknowledge the fundamental truth that we cannot save the planet without uplifting the voices of its people. And I think that's very profound.
I mean, that's really important. I think it's often neglected. You know, we see lots of articles that just tell us the top line, the nice stuff, and it's a bit superficial. Bjorn, what do you think the greatest challenge is facing people and planet?
Of course, with my work, food systems have been very challenged. Of course, what we've seen is actually inequity in the food system. A lot of times, it's not the limitation of production that there is a lot of food. It's just the distribution of food to those that are in need. And in Singapore, we started to look at that because we were doing a lot of growing of very high-end produce supplied to 70 odd restaurants. A lot of times, this does not address food inequity issues in Singapore. And we started working with migrant workers, which actually faced quite a bit of a challenge during the COVID lockdowns on access to food, and also elderly as well. And how do we bring food to them? And this lack of food sovereignty actually created inequity in that food system. And so in our small ways, how are we solving those problems in Singapore for those marginalized groups can really address the inequity in the food system.
Food system is profound. I'm just going to add a side note that, I contribute to the Daily Climate Show on Sky, which I have to say is on pause at the moment because of the Ukraine coverage, which tells us a lot about the situation. You know, we need to know about the environment more than ever, and actually there's a distraction. But anyway, George Monbiot, if you know him, I really recommend you read his books. I look to him as one of the greatest spokespeople on, let's say, sustainability. But his next big book, and what he always says to me, the biggest challenge is, absolutely, we have to overhaul our food systems for lots of different reasons. And there's obviously, they're very nuanced and complex, as we say about everything sustainability. But Kavita, what do you think? What do you think?
I love being the third person on this because I think the interconnectedness is so profound. I would obviously say that, you know, our natural world is at crisis and we need to protect it. But we need to protect it. We obviously need to protect it because it needs to be protected, but also for ourselves. As the people dependent on environment right now, the nature depends. 30% of climate solutions are nature-based. If we keep cutting down our forests and our mangroves and, you know, ruining our peatlands, we will never solve the climate problem. We will then get into, you know, more immigration issues and more issues of, you know, people moving and going into poverty. Poverty itself is the biggest threat to nature. We have profound loss of nature because of agriculture. Agriculture is the biggest cause of loss of ecosystems, and, you know, 30% of climate emissions come from agriculture. So you can start seeing how these things become connected in it. But really, the starting point has to be about protecting our forest. Just one thing. We just take the Amazon rainforest for granted. The Amazon rainforest is at a tipping point. We can any day switch it from a forest, which are the lungs of our world, to being a savanna grassland. And we will change our entire food system and throw people into poverty. So those interconnectedness and starting with those basic principles of protection and restoration and regeneration just have to be at the heart of what we do.
Absolutely, and I think, I don't know how to express it, but it's sort of like sustainability is non-binary. Everything is completely, it's not this or that, all of it is linked in terms of, you know, biodiversity. We hear that word, do we have to sort of, we need to boost biodiversity again because the planet and nature has to work together as one big functioning system. We're all part of that. We are nature. And I think a lot of urban residents forget that, actually. That's what we're sort of disconnected from it. So we talk a lot, as I say, about the complexities and the nuances. What are the main obstacles when it comes to navigating these in travel, do you think? And I will ask you, Kavita.
I think that there are a lot of challenges around this, and where we started off was actually to start going down to saying, what are the basic tenets? And we had a visual, if you can bring that up, of what does a sustainable tourism look like? And, you know, while we just tend to say, oh, it just depends on, like, protecting nature, it's not. It's actually getting the conservation storyline, but also getting the SMART goals that you can look at materiality, ensuring that there's commercial sustainability on all of these things, because they will not sustain, and all of you are from the industry, you know what it takes to get to that commercial sustainability as well. How do we get the people engaged? One of the real forgotten things about tourism is the equitable sharing of resources, of ownership, of those communities that live there, not just setting up something and giving them jobs. This is their land, their area where we are going in, and they need to own it. They need to see that benefit from it. But also about the supply chains. How do you source locally? How do you have that trickle-down effect of tourism into that? If you are taking people there to see certain species, I mean, look at the Rwanda gorillas, or you know, going into safaris for the Big Five, or coming to Colombia to see the birds, or to Southeast Asia to see our orangutans or the elephants or the tigers. If they are not protected, we will not sustain that tourism. So the base of all of these are about protecting these communities and these people. And so we really look at that. So one of the examples we have is the Skardamom Hills project that is in Cambodia. And we have a little visual on that just to show how you can bring private sector together with NGOs, in this case, the Wildlife Alliance, to create this very diverse cardamom tented camps in the mountains there that protect forests. So you actually have patrolling. You can take your customers to be part of those patrols, to have citizen signs, to go and find the snares that are capturing and killing our animals, to really bring people together into that community and bring the conservation core into some of those examples that we have of good tourism.
Thank you.
I mean, Juliet, if I could just add to that, from a business point of view, and I knew when I met you, we would be on the same wavelength. It's just good business anymore. And, you know, it isn't an add-on, because you are not only mitigating risk as a business person, but you're maximizing those opportunities, and you are protecting your future business as well as the future of the planet.
Yes, Bjorn.
But I think one of the major obstacles is always the kind of a debate on inconvenience, right? Sustainability means more expensive. It means it's really inconvenient. You choose between the compost toilet and flush toilet, right? Which will you choose? And that is that sort of mindset shift that needs to happen within travelers, that sustainability do sometimes come with some inconvenience as well. So just getting through that mindset shift.
Absolutely. That was actually, the point I was going to make was that, you know, a lot of what we're here for travel and tourism conversation, but it's universal, all of these themes. And I think absolutely the barriers are, we're addicted to convenience, we're addicted to bargains. And, you know, we just have to stop and sort of think about every decision that we make. I think if you speak to hoteliers, that's obviously me personally, that's my world professionally. I also work as a consultant with hotels. They'll tell you their barrier to sustainability is they don't have the time or the money to invest in initiatives that cost them time and money. So I think that's where the governance, the G, comes in. Also, things need to be managed, and they will be. You know, it's a very sobering fact that they, I mean, it's understood that, you know, if every single company or every commitment or pledge made at COP26 was upheld, we still don't stand a chance of making the 1.5 degree, you know, cap on the global warming heating. And so it's probably going to be 1.8 degrees. I mean,
it would want to be about 3 degrees.
This is really, really significant. So what are the obstacles? I think we need things to change. And we need to all better understand our role in that. I was also going to ask you about what does a positive impact tourism model look like? And I think, Kavita, you've really shown us that in terms of conservation. I think I loved, Bjorn, how you mentioned, you know, this is key in sustainability. It can't be extractive. It has to be restorative or regenerative. Can you speak more to that in terms of a tourism model?
Well, personally, I've done purpose-driven travel through volunteering and working on farms a lot of times, and you know, restoring 16th century barns in the middle of Wales, and farming rice in the middle of Seoul. So it's not so much more of a consumption travel. It was a more purpose-driven, it's more participative tourism, where I spent a lot more time with the community, with families, contributing to the local economy at the pub most of the time. And you know, the best conversations I had in the pub. I was in the middle of Scotland, and the pub owner loved me so much, he offered me a job. So I think that kind of experience and this participative tourism is really positive.
Actually, and what you're highlighting there, which is real, is interaction and engaging with one another. And I think for me, you know, one of the most powerful ways to recalibrate is community-based tourism. So it's about the people. It's about addressing the leakage issue so that more money stays in destinations where we travel and in local pockets. I would imagine, you know, that's very much a social impact-focused theme. I don't know if Jane, you wanted to add to that as well.
Yes, yeah. I think both for me as a traveler as well as someone who's been working in sustainability their entire career, that is what is very important to many travelers, or they're learning about it. They may not really think about it, but making sure that our dollars are staying where we're spending them is very important. And I have one other quote from Talbot Five, which I think many people in this room know, the former Secretary General of UNWTO. And Talbot always talks about you can't build a five-star resort in a two-star community. You have to build them both at the same time, and that is building the growth and more proactive, as well as, you know, it's protecting the economy and protecting people's livelihoods, but also using this opportunity to build community.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind, like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient, so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared.
Thank you so much. And I'm just going to quote the much wheeled out United Nations stat that, you know, typically of every $100 spent in luxury travel or tourism, only $5 stays in that local place where you're spending it. So that's a pre-pandemic stat, and it's significant. What I would really love to talk to you all about is, you know, what makes a destination particularly compelling from a sustainability point of view. Kavita, what do you think?
Well, tourism is all about pretty places and good food and, you know, all the experiences that we can have. So I think, you know, it's really about, for me, and I think from our perspective, it's really about finding the right place with the right people experiences in that. And of course, we now have 53% of, you know, travelers saying, in the latest booking.com thing, about saying that they want to look at sustainable tourism. But you also have like $343 billion going into wildlife tourism pre-COVID, and it'll hopefully come back. So for us, you know, the destination needs to speak to those, you know, experiences, but also really be grounded in the conservation elements that we want. I mean, we just have to say the loss of tourism in the last 2 years, of course, you know, you're from the industry, you know what it means to all of you. But from a conservation perspective, not getting money into those critical areas has meant that our protected areas management has not had funding. We've had to lay off rangers. We've had to lay off, you know, all the staff that works there. The communities that live there have not got incomes. So they are killing the animals, or poaching has gone up, or deforestation has gone up, because they absolutely need those resources. From a destination perspective, those are the areas that we need to get tourism back.
Absolutely. Thank you. And Bjorn, what are your thoughts?
I feel that, you know, it can't be just one narrative within a destination. It needs to be an ecosystem of experiences and diversity of experience, sustainable experience. If you're just going for one thing, you know, it lacks that. In the image that will be shown, we were trying to create this narrative around a single origin Singapore chocolate with Janice Wong, and probably 5 years back we would not have been able to do it. So we're planting 1,000 cacao trees in Singapore so that she can make her single origin chocolate. So the authentic story and the real story that has to come out to make it compelling for people to visit and participate in it is really important. So authentic stories, yeah.
Thank you. And after all, that's why we travel, to have authentic experiences of places different to what we know. And that addresses the very first point that was made about the rise in nationalism. Kavita, yes?
So Bjorn said a really interesting thing about Singapore. So I'm going to take a minute, since I do live there and work there. But I think that is a really good example of how we have taken urban travel and matched it really well in the new context with nature travel as well. Because a city, even a very urban city, allows you that experience and got a lot of green spaces going. We have national parks, we have, you know, mangroves and species coming back. I mean, in the urban context of looking at, you know, whether it's endangered species like the straw-headed bulbul, or looking at our Raffles banded langur, or the otters coming back because the waterways have cleaned up, or hornbills coming back, you know, which we had lost. So we are able to create those little patches of tropical forests, real wildlife experiences on the doorstep of a very urban environment, that kind of brings that, you know, as Bjorn was saying, the different elements together.
Thank you. Actually, I don't know how many of you know, but London's not far off qualifying as a park city. We just need to have a few more green spaces, I think, on roofs. I might fact check that. But that's quite interesting. However, Singapore is a garden city, and I just recalled something.
It's a city in nature. We've kind of moved from being a garden city to being a city in nature.
All I was going to say was I had a conversation with Bjorn about the significance or the distinction between a garden and a park, and I just wondered if it was such an interesting point you made.
Yeah, it's interesting that we named the organization Edible Garden City when Singapore was a garden city. But of course, Singapore, as progressive as it is, tend to change the narrative quite often, right? So now our name is not really applicable anymore. So, but I guess in what we have in Singapore, the green infrastructure is creating not parks, because in parks, people tend to be very disassociated. You're there walking a dog, you're there to exercise. But in the garden, people engage in the community, they share knowledge, they bicker a little bit, you know, politically. Why are you growing this thing? You're causing shade on my plant. But it becomes a community. So you have a lot more activity in a garden as compared to a park. So more gardens, less parks.
And again, I love that idea. I guess it's almost a metaphor, the garden bringing people together. It's more intimate, everyone communicating. I liked that image. So, you know, we're here to talk about walking the walk and moving beyond sustainability storytelling. What would your advice be to individuals and businesses who would like to walk less talk? I think we're all keen to know, you know, how either maybe it's not us applying it, but if we can pass that on through our work or our clients or whoever it is. Yeah, what advice would you have?
I think you have to start with setting goals and SMART goals. And we had one example that we were looking at. So you'll have to test me on this, but SMART includes being specific, measurable, actionable, relatable, traceable, transparent. And I think in that context, you know, one of the examples that we have here is this Burana Lodge, which is in Kenya, which was set up with a very clear goal of helping protect rhinos. Rhinos are one of the most endangered species we have. They worked very much with the communities there. They also created this very interesting financial system of where they were raising money from a number of their partners, but also from the different lodges and communities and co-investing it back. But they were very clear on what the goals were, which then allowed them to show how they were delivering against those goals, but also allowed them to communicate very clearly about what was the proposition from the tourism perspective, what were people contributing to, how that money was then actually resulting in that, how it was being shared back with the community. So I think, you know, if you can get those tenets right and then set the goals around that with the long-term conservation and then tell the story around it, because these places have amazing stories to be told, hopefully from the people themselves.
And I think that's one of the reasons we travel, is to understand and engage with these. That's these living, breathing case studies. We have a responsibility to maybe be more curious. That was something we talked about in the last session, but being curious and learning. And look, you know, when we talk about rhinos, it's not like, oh, poor rhinos. It's a big deal when anything in nature is disrupted. It's short circuits, you know, the system doesn't function. Sorry if I'm mumsplaining. That's what my daughter would say I'm doing right now. You probably, you know, realize that. Something I am going to add. Do you have other actionable advice or thoughts? Jane, you must do.
First, from the individual, as a traveler, do your research. Take the time, identify, whether it's through certifications or in the media, find out about the operators you're using, the destinations you're going to, and you know, make a pledge to yourself that you are going to be a responsible traveler. And there are examples of that that you can find, I believe, in Iceland and Palau. Actually, you have to sign, it's part of your passport to get into Palau, that you're going to be a responsible traveler. There easy ways to do it as well. Just, you know, take the train. You're close to, you know, it's easy when you're, you know, here in the UK and in Europe, less so in my home country, the United States. But if you are flying, find the carriers that are using more sustainable aviation fuel, or otherwise known as biofuels. Those are really making those efforts. And this data is available. Sometimes you just have to dig for it, but find it. Also look at hotels that are LEED certified or BREEAM certified. Those are opportunities. And of course, just going back to the social issues, be very respectful of the communities you're in. From a business, it's following these other models that exist in sustainable business. And again, as Kavita said, starts with SMART goals, identifying those, understanding what the material issues are for your business. And you can do that even if you're a small, medium-sized business. These are not only for Global 500 companies. And, you know, identify, is it prioritizing using less water, only having showers instead of bathtubs? An anecdote I'd love to tell came from when Cape Town was going through its drought, and one of the luxury hotels, you can message all you want and put signs up. They took all of the plugs out of the bathtubs, and if you wanted to take a bath, you had to go to the concierge, and they gave you a plug, but it now had a rubber duck on it. So you had to walk through the lobby, and everybody knew that you were taking a bath instead of like a 3-minute shower.
That's brilliant, which always follows my rule of edutainment. You know, you're educating and entertaining at the same
absolutely.
Time, the Holy Grail.
And I think, you know, another issue is paying the right wages, appropriate wages, whether that's a living wage, and making sure, again, that everybody in the travel industry is participating both financially as well as bringing all these great experiences to travelers.
I think from a business perspective, we have made the same mistake as well, right? Sort of scratching the surface and greenwashing the stories that we push out. But if businesses really need to approach sustainability from a system change perspective, the issue we're in, the challenge we're in, is a systemic problem, and they need to look at it holistically and not just fix little bits and pieces along the way so they can have a good marketing story. So be truthful about it. Yeah.
Really, as somebody who writes a lot about sustainability, that is absolutely key. I really hope everyone's sort of thinking about that. And just going back to something Kavita said, which is what I would really amplify, is supply chains. We are only as good as our supply chains. All the way down, it can be really complex. I'll just give you one little stat that will highlight that rather depressingly. You know, it's great, let's all get solar panels. Look at the solar panels in the UK. 40% of the solar panels in the UK were made in forced labor camps in China by Uyghurs. So that was all I'm saying, is like, you know, it's very nuanced, it's complex. We really need to look at every aspect of our sustainability. So, I love this. What terms do we love and loathe and why? I mean, you know, there's so many buzzwords out there. What do we think? Bjorn, what do you love or loathe?
I used to love the term farm to table. It was very romantic, right? Then one day, Antoine Baudin said, but everything is from the farm to the table, right? So it's kind of an oxymoron, isn't it? But if the next image to show you just how we actually translated very global North narrative, Jamie Oliver, which all of you know, when he started the restaurant in Singapore 8 years ago, it was very cliche, right? Community gardening, we ran that. We also played around with the foraging narrative for a long time with Western chefs coming into Singapore. Over time, in 10 years, we have started to explore Singapore's heritage of the indigenous people, of the Orang Laut people. And here you see on the right, Tim Rao came recently, and we did a session with Fridas from Orang Laut, and he was actually narrating stories about native plants and memories from his grandmother, and that becomes then that journey that we took from you know, greenwashing or trying to adapt a story from the global north to then finding our own voice in Singapore.
Thank you so much, Jane.
One I've used today is ESG, because it says what it is. It's very simple. It's to the point. It is a newer phrase. It might be, you know, it comes from the financial world, so very data-driven, and it might be on the verge of being overused. I hope not for all those reasons. One, I like less is anything eco, because I feel like that's greenwashing.
Eco. What does that even mean?
I mean,
now?
When it's first started, it was great, but I think it's overused.
Eco-friendly. Eco-friendly planes. That's my favorite one. Eco-friendly flights. They're never eco-friendly.
Oh, that list is endless.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Eco-tourism, sustainable tourism, conservation tourism, nature-based tourism, wildlife tourism.
These are the good guys.
These are the good guys, but who knows what they mean? And are they interchangeable? Does one, you know, differ from the other? I mean, but that's what I think we've kind of like lost the plot on that, the number of certification we have. I don't think even a lot of us who've like live our lives looking at certification. Carbon neutral travel. Oh, what does that mean? Bird friendly coffee.
Net zero.
What is that?
Does anyone else feel that way? I actually can't bear to hear something's carbon neutral or net zero. It doesn't. And poor 2030 is over there as a year cowering, going, everybody needs to be something by my year.
Yeah. So using simpler language would be so much better. I mean, so we're starting to just say wild places and wild animals. I mean, we at least get what that is. It doesn't include us. But, you know, so I think, you know, we have to break down this whole jargon. And what did I learn at business school? Jargon, right? Like, we can all just talk to each other in jargon.
I'm with you, honestly. We just have to qualify what we're saying. I think those of you who are journalists in the room, or anyone who's press, or you write communications, or anything like that, we have a huge responsibility. As I say, my mantra is to show, don't tell, and really qualify everything, and not just use these terms willy-nilly. And you know, there's so much greenwashing around at the moment. It's stifling. So we hear a lot about ESG, but there's not one universal standard of measurement. What do you think the key considerations are, Jane?
So speaking of certifications and standards, there's more than one. There are many. The good news is, in terms of disclosure, ESG reporting, we have seen a consolidation. We're in the process of a consolidation of some of, if not the standards yet, the organizations that are running them. So if you're familiar with some of the
business. Can you tell us what ESG is?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Environmental social governance is the term. Jane can, it's a term, but I mean, you can explain it better.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's the three pillars of sustainability: environmental, social, and governance in the business world. And as Juliet had mentioned, if you're talking in the governmental world, it's often environmental, social, and economic. So there are a lot of standards out there in terms of reporting, such as the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board, the Global Reporting Initiative, the Task Force on Climate Finance Disclosure. So it's an alphabet soup. And we're seeing a consolidation of that. I don't think we will ever get to one standard, because, you know, if we're looking from a business point of view, finance doesn't have one standard, at least a global standard. You know, the U.S. has a different standard than Europe does. And, you know, I think if you are looking for certifications, make sure that they are from a reputable organization, that they are relevant and material to your particular issue. So there are standards. If you're in travel, start with the GSTC. That's another acronym that I...
By the way, if you look at GSTC's Instagram today, they did a really great story, which was modeled on a Singapore hotel. If you go to their stories, and it shows a really nice methodology for measuring sustainability, just to side note.
So, you know, I wouldn't get caught up in the standards at the moment. Just start measuring. You measure, you know, on the environmental side, it's carbon, it's water, and it's waste. Those are the three big issues. Social issues are human rights, trafficking, modern day slavery, those types of issues. Obviously, wages, which I had mentioned before.
And if maybe you're not feeling that, you're still like, okay, what is ESG still? So just remember, we used to talk about CSR, so corporate social responsibility. That was a term used for companies or businesses. They would talk about that. Now very much in the business sector, they have to think about and measure their ESG. It's just that there's not a universal framework. So it's like they'll all talk a good ESG game. It's very much, that's why it's danger of just becoming a buzzword, because it's not official. Nothing's formalized. None of these terms are formalized.
No, and there has been an evolution, as you know, you said, from CSR, citizenship, or other words that are used. And we're seeing more focus on using the term sustainability, ESG, as the, you know, sustainability itself is an industry and how the space has evolved. Also the nomenclature has evolved, but we still have that challenge. One other thing I just wanted to add, and it just I'm not going to add it because it just popped out of my mind.
Well, we've got a few minutes left, so think about
to be transparent.
Think about your very difficult questions that you're going to ask us all. Please throw them at us. I'm realizing, we're being quite serious, but sustainability, there's a lot to tackle, a lot to think about. I'm going to ask, on a positive note, what are we really excited about? What can we be excited about? And what is next in the sustainability conversation? Kavita, what do you think?
Borrowing something from the food side, I just love the concept of slow food or slow travel. And I think, obviously tourism is not all good. We've had lots of issues of tourism. Tourism is one of the biggest climate emitters, greenhouse gas emitters as well. It can be, from a people side, it can be very exploitative. It does take a lot of resources out of communities and out of nature. But this whole idea of giving back and more experience and more education, entertainment. So slow travel, which would be don't take lots of weekend trips and lots of air miles, but take a destination, take the time to spend there, to see, immerse yourself in whether it's Japan or Singapore or New York, but more and more into natural environments. And we're seeing post-COVID, people are really feeling from a health and mental wellness, well-being, the need to be in these spaces. Yeah. So we just need to slow it down.
Yeah. Thank you, Jane.
Completely agree with that. I would take it one step further and use travel as a way to educate people about sustainability. And all those aspects that you've mentioned in the environmental and social.
Absolutely, thank you. And Bjorn, what would you say?
I think I shared this before, but really the sort of resurgence of participative tourism, more of the woofing, more of the couch surfing.
Do you know what woofing stands for?
Yeah, so worldwide opportunities on organic farm. Used to be willing workers on organic farms, and you spend time in exchange for food and lodging. You work on the farm. And the network is global network, right? You can experience. I went to Japan and did woofing. Every morning I woke up, Mount Fuji was just there. So I met Japanese that have not seen Mount Fuji before because it's always covered in clouds, right? so that kind of experience and that participative tourism and immersive tourism. It's really exciting for me. Yeah,
and I'm excited personally. I love that hotels are offering behind-the-scenes tours now. That's something I'm really enjoying, and businesses are really pulling back the curtain and allowing you to see how their operations work, and it's a great education, so thank you.
Didn't in COVID times a lot of the hotels and destinations just allow people to live there for months? Like, isn't that one of the big trends we've seen of if you are working from home, work from Barbados? Or, you've had that big shift in tourism right now. People just living longer in destinations.
And moving around as promads. Oh, buzzword, professional nomad. Absolutely. That's a great, people are traveling. Well, that's part of your slow as well, traveling less and for longer. We've obviously covered a lot, and I really would love to take some audience questions. Have you got any questions, please? Great. I think, do we have to surrender? We'll have to surrender one of our mics. Thank you so much.
Regarding sustainable tourism, where are the great examples in the world of where sustainable movement within cities is really forward thinking with regard to not only tourism, but also the local community?
Cities is harder because I think Singapore could be an example, but I think from a broader tourism perspective, we see a lot of really good examples out there. So, I'll take one from Namibia, the Wolvedans, where they actually work with community conservancies and ownership, bringing in private sector investment and skills to really look at nature conservation, and that really coming together with the tourists then being, a core part of that. Or you look at wilderness safaris or, blue ventures. So there's a lot of examples where these things are definitely coming together. I think from a city side, it's more, I think we need to work harder at it. But what we are seeing a lot is this rise of you know, more participatory actions and more experiential things. So, you know, city tours, cultural tours, food tours, nature tours.
Bjorn, did you have thoughts?
I agree. Cities are quite challenging. Of course, Singapore is making quite a lot of headways into it because of broader commitments from the government. Of course, you know, I've seen examples in Belize, again, conservation, but, you know, you can be a ranger for a day and, you know, go find where the traps are. And, you know, you can be very participative. But yeah, I think we need to work harder on cities. Yeah,
I'm going to comment and say I think cities are great, and actually a lot of them do. You know, a big neglected part of the sustainability conversation is accessibility and diversity, and I think a lot of city hotels really model proactive.
Well, I'd like to give a plug for Chicago, where I currently live, which is one of the best cities in the world, and is doing all the things. The greatest city in the world, as our local historian says, but it is accessible. There's a great mass transit system. You live on a great lake, and it's got wonderful things to see. But I'd also say the Galapagos, because it's regulated. Because they just, as this discussion has shown, if we don't take care of these jewels, they will disappear. And they're really limiting the number of people and the sizes of the ships that are going into the Galapagos. And I think they're doing a very good job of that.
Great. Well, thank you so much. I saw Vicky Smith from Earth Change just put her hand up. I know that she has a question. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Julia. Vicky Smith from Earth Changes, founder. I deal with positive impact tourism. I'm a specialist. The big question for me is consumer demand. You know, I've worked in sustainable tourism 15 years. I've worked in general mainstream travel industry 25 years. And there is immense stuff going on locally, for conservation, community, and we all know, those of us here, that there is incredible opportunity, particularly at this time, post-COVID, because of the consumer greater understanding and awareness of the need to connect to nature, to community, to love, to caring for our planet. So the question, which is always the challenge, is how do we get consumers to change? Because the opportunity is there, the supply side is there, the technology is there. The surveys are there that says consumers want to do it, and yet the consumer behavior is that it sticks to what it knows without willing to make a real jump and a real change. And that's what's required in order to really push sustainable tourism on that trajectory.
So how do we make us people, how do we inspire behavioral change?
I think you just start offering, like, it's not a choice. It's just the way that you do business. And I think you won't lose many customers. You will get millennials and Gen Z, because just as they are tech savvy and native to tech, this is what they look for. It's the way that they live their lives. And I would also get ahead of the curve, because it's going to be more regulated. We're seeing that in cruising and in ports, even though perhaps luxury travelers are not asking for it. You're going to have to do it as a business.
And I think just facilitate virtue signaling wherever you can. I'm not, you know, there's no problem with people doing that if it's actually going to demonstrate that they're doing better. I'll give you an example. I just took the train across Europe, and hotels will offer you a special price if you've taken the train. They'll give you a good rate. It's incentivizing people in that way, and allowing them. That's my thought.
Absolutely. I think one of the trends that I was reading about was how everyone wants to have an Instagrammable image from their travel. So everyone's looking for that unique experience, that unique photograph, that, you know, unique story that they're telling. And I think a lot of sustainable travel actually lends itself better to that trend, where you can actually customize a little more, make it core of, you know, part of the offer. But also there is, in my mind, this thing of, you know, which I don't have an answer to, of saying what is mass tourism or versus what is specialist tourism, and, you know, do you have a Nepal type business where it's all about mass backpackers, or is it more the Bhutan model where it's more, you know, regulated? And I think in both scenarios, right, you can decrease the amount of impact that the tourist has, or amp up the amount of experience that they have. And I think those are the models that we want. But I think at a core, what we would like is that these are non-negotiables. I think like any other sector, this has to be at least core basic sustainability of how operations are run are not optional.
So thank you so much. We're going to take one more question. I'm just going to make a side comment about the Bhutan model. I'm sure you know, but it's just that they don't have so many visitors at all, and they have much higher spend. They have to. And that sounds very elitist and exclusive, but it means less people spending more money is the holy grail. But at the same time, you need to make it accessible, I believe, for the domestic market. So you mentioned Namibia earlier. That's where it was challenging during the pandemic. They didn't have a domestic market. So we constantly have to think sustainability is non-binary. So question we have...
Hi, I'm Claire from Travel Weekly.
Oh, hello, sorry.
Hello, hi. So we're a publication that works with the travel trade. Just following on from Vicky's question, I absolutely agree that I think we do need to make it non-negotiable for sustainable travel to be an option. What do we do in the meantime, you know, to encourage and persuade and sell those trips that are more sustainable and encourage people to make more sustainable choices when there are lots of options that aren't very sustainable?
Who would like to answer that? I could talk for days on that one, but who would like to answer that?
This is reminiscent of a number of sectors, you know, taking examples from other sectors so we can learn. And I think the food sector has definitely been one where there's a lot of discussion of saying, oh, but it's cheaper to buy mass-produced food, whereas food that is good for you, healthier for you, more nutritious, is more expensive. And we've still started to see slight shifts in that because people then realize what's in it for them. And I think we've always found that you can always, well, we can't always, but it's easier to sell something when they see what's in it for them than to say, oh, it's better for the environment or it's better for the animals and it's better for the people. So I think, you know, if we can use that hook, especially in times of like, you know, all this health and well-being, and you know, we talk about forest bathing all of these new concepts. I think we need to translate that and find those hooks a little better. And I think the millennials are more open to it.
I completely agree. I really want to sort of emphasize that too. You know, people are selfish and they're allowed to be a bit selfish with their trips and the holidays. So if you can just say, look, you know what, it's the right thing to do, but it also feels nicer. It's more nutritious, let's call it, to take the sustainable trip. And I do think travel agents and travel operators have a huge responsibility to think about that properly. I don't think that they do a good enough job at the moment in the mainstream.
I would add, certainly education is a big part of it. But I would look at sustainability as the new luxury and sell it that way.
Thank you. I mean, I really thank you so, so much. I don't think we've got time for any more questions. I'm so sorry. I found that a really, really edifying, important conversation. Thank you so much to everyone. Thanks to my panelists. Thank you to the Singapore Tourist Board for hosting this and putting it together. And of course, to Intelligence Squared.